Slow Burn Media and Bill Huffman present Who Killed? A podcast that provides a voice for the voiceless. Hello, and welcome to this week's episode of Who Killed Amy Mahalovic? I am the host and producer, Bill Huffman, and on this week's episode, we will take a deep look into the case that has haunted the community for nearly 30 years, and we will discuss some of the possible leads that have come from the podcast, as well as the documentary that aired on Investigation Discovery. I sit down with Chief of Bay Village Police, Mark Spetzel, and we discuss thoroughly about pretty much any question or comment that people had raised throughout the podcast. So sit back, take a listen. Hopefully, Chief Spetzel will be able to provide some of the information that you, the listeners, have been looking for. And again, this case is never over until it's solved. So we might as well just jump right into the conversation with Chief Spetzel. And again, if you have any information regarding this case, I will provide phone numbers and contact information at the end of this episode for you to reach out and help solve this case. Okay, so it's been about 8 months since we first met. Mm-hmm. And a lot's happened since then.
A lot of publicity.
We've had a lot of publicity. We've had some anniversaries. Mm-hmm. What do you think the impact of participating in something like as public as the documentary and the podcast that you participated in, you know, do you feel like that provided an impact into the case? Did it help?
Yeah, absolutely. I've always said that we're going to need the media's assistance to get out word to the public, because the public, I still believe, is the key to solving this crime, and therefore we need their input, and sometimes we have to remind them, you know, we have to kind of prompt them a little bit that this case is still out there unsolved and we need their help in solving it. So the podcast, the documentary, after each one we received additional leads and tips. So it served its purpose. You know, we're never done until this case is solved, so we will always, you know, look for media to assist us in getting that word out. But you know, there's no doubt in the last year that there's been a renewed interest in the public.
Yeah, and I would agree that there's definitely been a renewed interest for sure. And I think with the new technology, and I mean, you look at back at 2018 and people will look back, I mean, people who look at cold cases, people like myself or people who are investigators, will look back and say, okay, this was the watershed year where, you know, it kind of had the turning point where, okay, we can take this information that we had from maybe 20 years ago and now we can actually use it. Do you feel like, you know, since the case like April Tinsley was solved and Christy Merrick and, you know, using these genealogical databases, do you feel like those are something that could help solve this case?
Not today. However, in the future, with increased technology and advancement in DNA, we have always tried to stay on the forefront of DNA information, and usually that's through the private sector. Public sector catches up with the private sector at some point. So we watch to see what's coming out as far as technology and advancements in DNA on the private sector. And we understand that, I mean, that increases exponentially, right? So technology that we existed 5 years ago, we thought was great, has expanded tremendously in just the last 5 years. So we're wondering what the next five years is going to bring us. So we try to keep that in mind as we do analysis of any DNA. And as you know, we have DNA in this case. But as I've always said, it's not the DNA that you're going to throw into the CODIS database, the national database of convicted offenders, and get a hit back. So we can't do that. So we have other ways of working with that DNA. But keeping in mind that our technology we have today does not allow us to definitely use that familiar DNA, which you've heard so much about in 2018.
Right.
We're not to that point with our DNA yet.
Okay. So the DNA that was used to solve those cases, they may have had a bigger or a larger piece of DNA.
They had different DNA that was more effective to be utilized in that case, right? We do not have that. But we're hoping that someday the technology will advance to the point where with what we have, they'll be able to use that type of technology, but we're not quite there yet.
Now, recently there was you know, news stories about, and it, even on my podcast, it was mentioned that there were three hairs found. Is there anything that you can comment on that?
No, I'd prefer not to comment on the type of DNA that we have or the nature of it, keeping in mind that it's someday I could be sitting across from the person who did this, and there's certain information that only us as investigators and the killer is going to know. And we like to keep that, you know, pretty solid. Because it's not unusual for somebody to confess to a crime they didn't commit, ironically, and we need to be able to drill down into that information to determine if the person's actually involved.
Well, in this case, that actually did happen, right?
It happened several times, yeah.
And, you know, and that basically, what, just creates a, you know, your fool's errand.
Mm-hmm. Well, you think of the JonBenet Ramsey case and other cases that are high profile, people have a need for whatever reason to insert themselves and garner attention. So it's not unusual, and we understand that, so we have to be prepared for that kind of thing, and we are prepared for that.
So, like, yeah, the idea that somebody could step forward and say, hey, I did this, but you had to check these certain boxes in order to say...
Correct.
Yeah,
they
you're
really
the perpetrator.
The information. Correct.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Now, in regards to, you mentioned staying up to date with what the private sector is doing, does the private sector reach out to you also? Is that something that they... do, or is that something that you just have to keep up with yourself?
I wouldn't say they reach out to us. They're more than willing to work with us if we reach out, but we're not quite at the point to work directly with them. It's more of we like to see where the technology is going. And you know, of course, the public DNA experts, those at the labs, they kind of keep up on this as well. So we get information from them about where the technology is headed and what the possibilities are in the future. But we also reach out to the private labs and say, where are you at? What are you doing? What's coming down the pike? So we have some idea of where we might be going.
Gotcha. Now, as far as one of the questions that arose during the podcast was from, you know, from listeners, and that was, you know, why in 2016 did you release the blanket and the curtain, and why did you wait the 27 years to do that?
Well, it really wasn't a matter of waiting. What it was is a matter of resubmitting evidence that had already been analyzed using new technology, and that new technology identified things that we hadn't seen before. So you have, again, we had a ton of evidence from Ashland County that was picked up. We resubmitted as much as we possibly could to have a new look at it. And again, the technology back then is not the technology of today. So in resubmitting it, they found things they had not discovered before, and that's why that came out. So it really wasn't a matter of withholding it. It was a matter of identification.
Yeah, and one of the questions that people are, you know, they question is because, well, how are they going to remember what they had 27 years ago?
Mm-hmm.
But if I think back to any cases or any old cases or open cases, you know, there isn't really necessarily a... you know, website that's got all the pictures of everything that was found.
That's
so
right.
It's not like this was, I mean, yeah, that's all great to look back in hindsight, 2020, but in reality, you can't just throw all this stuff out there, especially in 1989.
Well, you don't know what evidence means until you can connect it to something.
Right.
So a piece of paper you find on the road near a crime scene means absolutely nothing until you can connect it to something. If you were to throw out everything, it would just be a gumbled mess of stuff. And until you can show some value of that evidence, it really isn't worthy to put out in the public because it means nothing at that point.
And you had boxes upon boxes.
Yeah, we collected hundreds of items just from the body area.
So it's just impossible to know what's what.
Right.
And then what should the public even know?
Yeah, and it's not something you would do in any investigation is just take all your evidence, take pictures, and throw it out to the public and say, hey, what do you guys think? I mean, that would be a nightmare.
Right, and with armchair, you know, detectives these days,
sure.
And I think that's where a lot of that question comes from, you know, the armchair sleuths, and hey, you know, to each his own. But the question, you know, I just had to ask a question in regards to, you know, what the delay was. It wasn't really a delay. It was just the technology wasn't there yet.
That's
and
right.
Just like you said about, you know, a few minutes ago, was the technology isn't there yet to use the DNA that you have.
Right. You know, this case will be 30 years old this year, her abduction in October, and there's very little information that we have not made public that is important. I mean, after 30 years, what are you going to retain? You know, again, we retain certain things, knowing full well that if we're sitting across from the person who did this, we want information that only he and the investigators know. But other than that, most of the information on this case has been out in the public. There's really no reason after 30 years to hide anything. We want to solve it. However that happens, if a private citizen brings forth something that solves the case, great. They get credit for that. We don't care who gets credit. We just want to have it solved. So we're not in the job of, you know, parsing out information here and there just to kind of keep feeding. That's not what we're doing. Again, the curtain was put out because of new technology identified a thing. If there was something else that was valued, we would have put it out already, unless we developed it, you know, from here on out.
Yeah, so a lot of the stories that you're seeing on the news and stuff right now is basically, they're kind of just doing the anniversary stories and follow-ups and kind of covering the information that's already been out in the public for a decent amount of time.
Correct.
So in your opinion, there isn't really any new information that has come out that would be imperative to...
For the public to know. You know, we have received probably well over 100 tips. You know, and some of those tips are rehashed from old tips. Some are new information. You know, and tips have, some have more value than others, but we look at all of them. So we're going through all these tips.
When did those tips come in?
They started in 18. You know, we got some after your podcast. We got some after the anniversary. We got some after the documentary aired. So they come in spurts as information goes out. And so we look at every tip that comes in, we're looking at it. I think what the public needs to understand too is that when a tip comes in, we don't go back to the tipster and say, here's what we found. You know, that's just not proper investigative protocol. So a lot of people feel as though, okay, I provided information, I never heard anything, so I don't think they did anything with it. Well, nothing could be further from the truth. The reality is we can't go back to, you can just imagine somebody would make something up just to find out what the investigation is doing if the reality was that investigators got back to everybody who submitted a tip. And I think most people understand that. They just want to see it solved. They're not looking. You know, there's a natural curiosity, obviously. But if somebody's giving information solely so they can find out where it goes, we're not in that business. We don't do that. No. So the idea here is if you submit a tip, we get back to many people. Some we don't. But we get back to them because we have follow-up questions for them. So if somebody calls in a tip and they don't hear back from us, they can rest assured that we followed up on it, but we didn't need any more additional information from them. If it leads somewhere, eventually they may find out because we'll contact them again. But the bottom line is we don't get back to people with answers to what their tip meant. We just don't do that.
And I think that that is an absolutely great thing to say, because a lot of people are under that misconception that once you phone a tip in and you don't hear anything, then they feel like, oh, it went into the ether, and it's and they don't care.
Yeah.
And like you just said, it's the furthest thing from the truth.
Right. I understand that perspective, though. If I'm calling something in, how do I know that it was followed up on? You know, that's what we do. We devote a lot of hours to these follow-up, and they take time. So even tips we got last year, we're not through all those tips.
Yeah.
Because they take time.
And if you did follow, I mean, let's say you did reach out to the people that did put in those tips, you'd have to have a whole new department for that.
Just to get back to them.
Right. And that's just, it's...
Right. But sometimes things develop and we have further questions for the tipster, and we'll get back with them and ask them those. And we always ask, you know, do you have contact information? So if we have further questions, we can contact you. And like I said, sometimes we do that.
Now, one of the questions that arose that I just was inquiring and wondering about when I was putting together the podcast, it came up in one of the episodes, and whatever happened to Amy's backpack? Was that ever found?
It was never found, no. Well, we know that we know that it's missing.
Okay. Because it's just always never one of those things that's referenced as those, like, oh, these three items are the ones that we think that would keep as a trophy.
The reason for that is, you know, while that description has been put out there, backpacks are more of a generic type of item that could be anywhere. I mean, I'm sure that the backpack she had there were probably thousands and thousands of them made, if not more. Whereas things like the earrings, the binder, the boots were unique items that you're not going to find in everyday life. And so that if somebody comes across them, they're more readily identifiable.
Right. Shoe size.
Shoes. Yeah. I mean, you know, it's just her shoes were very specific. And again, you're right. You know, they're a certain size, they're a certain make, they're a certain... Very unusual, the riding boots. Mm-hmm. This is not a common item you would find in most people's homes. A backpack, yeah. The windbreaker she was wearing, yeah.
So the windbreaker was also not found.
The windbreaker was also not found, right. So there are certain items they believe that she left to go to school with that were not at school, not at home, that were never discovered.
Interesting. Now, you know, it's odd that she left her bike. You know, the question, you know, she left her bike at the school, and the fact that it was a warm day. Mm-hmm. You know, I still go back to that. The chances of it being a warm day on October 27th in Northeast Ohio aren't good. Mm-hmm. And it's like, the perpetrator who set this up, I mean, what did he do? Did he tell? Do you think he told? I mean, obviously you can't answer this, but because you don't know. But I mean, why did she leave her bike at the school and not ride her bike over to the plaza? That's the
hard to say. You know, obviously you could project all you want. We know that she walked over to the plaza with two of her friends.
Right.
And I'm sure the expectation was that she was not going to be gone long, that she'd be coming back, and she'd be riding her bike home. I'm sure that was the expectation.
Yeah, and a lot, you know, another question that I had was she under, do you think she was under the impression that she was just going to be shopping at that plaza?
We have no really way of knowing that. I don't think people in Bay consider that a mall. And the information we have is that she would be going to a mall to go shopping, so therefore, I don't think she probably thought that, but we have really no way of knowing for sure.
Yeah, it's just one of those interesting things that, you know, and you always wonder what, obviously, what was going through this guy's mind. And
absolutely,
when I first met with you,
sure,
you know, that's the question. You know, what were you thinking that day? What was your plan?
Exactly.
Just recently, over the weekend, Angela Hicks. Mm-hmm. They arrested that guy, Samuel Legg. He was 21. What was that? 20. He was 21 at the time.
He would have been very young at the time.
Yeah,
yeah, 21 years old.
21 years old. He wouldn't be looked into, would he?
We look at everybody that has a propensity to do this. Obviously, he would have been young.
Yeah.
But you have somebody like that who is now being accused of multiple crimes, including rapes and murders. Obviously, it's somebody to look at. Sometimes it's very easy to rule these people out, and sometimes it's more difficult. But we look at anything like that where there's the possibility, based upon their behavior, that it's something they could do.
Are you familiar with the case? And I've never come across a case since Amy's where the phone was used as a ruse. Mm-hmm. But there was a case in Toronto in 86 or 87. The girl named Allison Perrot, or I think Allison Parrott or Allison Perrot. Okay. But she was lured by a guy who said, "Hey, I'm a photographer. I want to take some pictures for your track team. You meet me at this location, and your other teammates are going to be there." And then they found her body.
Yeah.
But they ended up finding the killer.
The killer for that one, yeah.
For that one. But it was the first time that I ever, you know, this was 86. And it's like 89 was kind of like it was right before the technology started to get better, where you could track people's phone numbers and you could get caller ID and Star 69 and all of that stuff that basically didn't exist. I mean, you guys obviously, you know, I know Special Agent Torsney mentioned this, that you guys are always looking at other cases, you know, across the country. Have you had any other similar cases that you've seen where, like, the MO is even remotely similar, where the guy used the phone as a...
There's other cases that have some similarity. There's nothing that is completely the same. You know, there's no case out there that mirrors Amy's case. And so you always look for the connections. The MO obviously is extremely important. That often doesn't change. What will change is the technology for that MO. So what was a phone call in 89, you know, in the 90s, 2000s became a, you know, something on the internet.
An instant message or something.
And before the phones, it was a stranger, you know, walking down the street, you know. So there... But those kind of random things. But in this case, what's unique about this, and we don't find a whole lot, is the setup, the planning that went into it, where he actually is contacting Amy on at least one, if not multiple occasions, to set up a meet that ultimately is going to be the abduction. Most abductions of children, if they're not for familiar, you know, purposes, ransom, are just random chance encounters.
Crimes of opportunity.
At the wrong time. Crimes of opportunity. That's not what we had here. She was targeted. You don't see that very often. So That is a key piece we look for. We also understand that we don't think this happened in a vacuum, that this is the only crime this individual ever committed. So you're looking to see, okay, what did they do before this? What did they do after this? Is there a chance they repeated the behavior? Was there crimes that led up to this that are like precursor crimes, whether it's a telephone harassment, burglaries, stalking, voyeurism, those type of things? So you're always looking for that type of behavior. And we look nationally because we don't know if this person came, lived in Ohio prior to, if he moved from Ohio after. We don't know those facts. So that's why we throw it out nationally as well.
Right. And now we talked earlier about the, you know, false leads and, you know, people calling in tips that may not be, you know, just wanting to be a part of the story.
Sure.
Did you feel like all of the people that were contacted in North Olmsted were associated with this caller, or is there some question whether or not that is, I mean, is it 100% proven that they're...
No, I don't think anything's 100% proven.
Okay.
But it was similar enough given the circumstances that we feel pretty comfortable that it could be related.
How many girls?
But we looked at two very closely.
Okay.
But again, we put out information Northeast Ohio wide to all the schools to send home to their parents to have this done. And there were much more than two that were, you know, somewhat similar. But these kind of, when you boil it down and you look at the circumstances, were the closest to Amy's. But there were a lot of others as well. But the circumstances didn't line up as closely as those did.
Now, were any of those cases, like, close to being a victim? Or did it get any further than...
Just calls in, you know, I came home from school, a guy called and wanted to talk to me, or, you know, asked if my parents were home. I said no and hung up. You know, it could be any number of different things like that. Keeping in mind that back in the 70s and 80s, those type of phone calls used by folks was not that uncommon, you know.
You mean making
phone calls.
Like obscene phone calls.
And they weren't necessarily all to lure kids either.
Right.
They're the obscene phone calls.
I received
one. It's like the texting,
one.
The random texting of today was the phone calls of the 80s and 70s. So.
Interesting.
So those things happened, you know, and for whatever strange reasons people enjoyed making those kind of calls, they did.
Yeah, I mean, prank calls. I mean, it was a
prank calls or sexually oriented type of calls. Those things happened.
They did.
So, but again, unique. You got to look at the unique circumstances of each call.
Yeah, and the fact that he actually had a conversation with her and set something into motion where he could literally have just been picked up by you or any other officer.
Right.
If she would have come to you and said, "Hey, I'm supposed to meet this guy this afternoon."
Yeah, like, it would have been nice to meet there.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It would have been great. I mean,
it's
like. You know, if you
and then again, the
time.
Technology back then didn't allow us to track those kind of local phone calls that were made. So that obviously.
Yeah,
today,
and that's another question everybody asks is like, well, why didn't they track the phone numbers? Well, the phone numbers were only tracked if they were long distance.
Yeah, there was no computerized record for those kind of phone calls. Long distance, yes, which we did. Local, no.
And the fact that there were no long distance phone calls that were suspicious.
Correct.
Obviously led to
right.
the fact that this guy had to be making a local call.
Correct.
But that doesn't mean that he couldn't have come from somewhere out of and then made
it. No
him.
Idea. But. Yeah, the only thing I can tell you is, you know, that for somebody, the FBI behavioralists will tell you that for somebody to commit a crime like this, they have to have some familiarity with where the abduction takes place. They need to have some familiarity where the body is disposed of. And in this case, 50 miles apart, we're always looking for those connections, as we've talked about before.
Right. And... You know, the parents were obviously not suspected right off the bat. You know, there was no suspicions of the parents. And, I mean, you're pretty much left with what the kids are told you. And for 30 years almost, we've been basically, I mean, the story that we know is what she told her friends.
Correct. Had she not talked to her friends, we'd know a lot less today than we currently do. So you're correct. We are relying on the information obtained from her friends.
Mm-hmm.
That she relayed to them. That's really what it comes down to. And then also the eyewitness testimony of young fifth, sixth graders that saw her at the shopping center. But that's all you've got. So it makes it, That's why I say there's nothing 100%, because eyewitness testimony is often seen generally as somewhat unreliable. It can be very reliable, or it could be very unreliable. It depends on the individual, their perception, and time frames, and all kinds of different things come into play. But when that's all you've got, for example, we threw out the composite drawings based upon her friends seeing Amy with this individual. And then we've had tips where people say, well, the person I'm thinking of looks like that, but the jaw's a little different. Well, you can't rely on those type of very specifics in a composite. Composite drawing is more or less a general appearance of what somebody looked like. It's not going to be specific down to eyes and nose and glasses, all uniformly, yeah, this is the exact person. That's not the way a composite generally works. So that in and of itself, when it was put out days after the abduction, generated literally thousands of leads that had to be followed up on.
And a majority of those leads were just lookalike
leads. Just lookalikes. And a lot of those you could easily establish alibis. The person was at the grocery store working that day, seen by 10 people. Okay, check that off. But you follow up on all those because you don't know. And so that involved a lot of investigative resources. And even though we had probably 40 to 60 agents working on the case immediately after it happened, that eats up a lot of resources.
Oh, yeah. I mean,
but when that's all you've got, you go with what the information is you have available.
Yeah, and again, this wasn't something that you guys waited 24 hours. This was something that was
immediate.
In the works. Boom,
Right.
Margaret came to you guys, and it was on the media or on the news that night. And
correct.
The firestorm started that day, and it hasn't stopped really since.
Exactly right.
You mentioned earlier that you don't think this happened in a vacuum. You think that he may have committed other crimes?
Other crimes. I wouldn't say exactly of this type, but I would imagine that for somebody to jump from a normal life, whatever you want to call it, to this type of crime would be a huge stretch. There's usually some behavior that is noticeable in somebody that would commit this type of crime. And often it manifests itself in criminal activity. So there's a possibility that after the crime, he didn't do anything. But there's a really good chance that before the crime, there was some behavior that people would recognize. Again, things like making phone calls, making prank calls, making sexual type crimes, burglaries, voyeurism,
pushing the envelope each time.
He's testing to see where his point is, and generally what happens, they'll keep escalating. This is not enough anymore. It's kind of like a drug.
Mm-hmm.
You take
yeah.
a certain level of drug and it's fine, but then you become used to that and you need a little bit more.
Right.
This type of behavior is not. I mean, it's pretty analogous to that, and I think that you would see a slight progression. Does that mean that there's not a chance that, he just has a one and done? Yeah, there's always the exceptions, right? And we have to consider that. But more often than not, there's a pattern to this.
Yeah, so he could easily have just changed his MO and, technology is going to catch me if I do it that way, so
yep.
I'm going to move
on. I'm
going
to use the internet now, and I'm going to lure kids through the internet. Or, the classic of a pedophile getting involved in a group that has access to kids, that still happens. Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, church, any sports leagues.
School.
You name it. School, teachers. It's very common for those that have an interest in a certain group to get involved in those groups. I mean, it's common. So that could be in a play somewhere, too. You don't know. So you have to look at all avenues, and that's what makes this so frustrating for law enforcement is we've looked at all these angles, and you're just not finding that one thing that's a home run.
And you keep going back, and you circle back, and you look, and you look, mm-hmm. and you look, and you still can't find that one thing. You mentioned last time about the electronic database.
Mm-hmm.
Now, is that something that, it's completed and you're able to use it?
Yeah, we have an electronic database that basically has all our tips and leads in it, has all our follow-up investigations. We can search that database by names and in a lot of different ways. That database contains, I wouldn't even want to guess, I have a way to quantify it, thousands upon thousands of suspect names in it. Interviews, at least that number of interviews times whatever. You think about one individual might be called and a suspect could have 50, 60 interviews associated with it. another person who was a lookalike, and we went to the store and found out he's working, might have one or two. But when you're looking at thousands of people, you know, just imagine the amount of interviews and information that is connected to those individuals. So all that is in a database, not even a database. It's more of a, it's on a server, mm-hmm. and it's searchable.
Let's hear from this week's sponsor, BetterHelp.com. As you guys know, 2020 was terrible, and things are still pretty terrible. But today I am happy to tell you about BetterHelp.com. Because if there's anything that's holding you back or interfering with your happiness, BetterHelp Online Counseling is there for you. You can connect with a professional counselor in a safe and private online environment. And it's really convenient because with the current state of the world, it really needs to be. So now you can get help on your own time and at your own pace. All you have to do is schedule secure video or phone sessions, and you can also chat and text with your therapist. BetterHelp really is there for you. They have over 3,000 U.S. licensed therapists across all 50 states. And if, for whatever reason, you aren't happy with your counselor, you can request a new one at any time. They even have apps for your smartphone or your computer, so you are never out of touch. So again, if you're suffering from anxiety or depression, anger, stress, relationship issues, heck, not getting good enough night's sleep, trauma, LGBT matters, they literally have a licensed professional counselor for you. And of course, everything you share is confidential. And the thing I like most is that this is actually an affordable option. And Who Killed listeners get 10% off their first month with the discount code WHO. So why not get started today? Go to betterhelp.com/WHO. All you have to do is fill out a questionnaire to help them assess your needs and get you matched with a counselor that you'll love. Again, for 10% off, go to betterhelp.com/WHO.
Like, it's dedicated to this case.
Yep.
You put in a name and boom, and it could
pull up information.
All the information related to that individual.
Right.
That's, and so you also mentioned in our interview over the summer or last spring, whenever it was, about the money starting to run out.
Mm-hmm.
Are we reaching that point?
We are. We are reaching that point. Like I said, the state of Ohio has been very generous in giving us a couple of grants to continue this. I think that funding is almost up. The city has also assisted in additional money for the investigation, specifically to keep Phil Torsney working. You know, we'll still work creatively to try to find ways to do that. Bottom line is we're a public entity. This is our job. So however we have to do it, we'll do it. But certainly when you work as diligently as we do, it requires a lot of resources. And at some point, if there's not money available, that kind of workload is going to have to be reduced because there's just not the manpower to do it. But we're going to continue. I've dedicated myself to making sure this keeps going.
Right.
So we'll continue to do that.
So Special Agent Torsney is still assisting.
He's still assisting currently.
Excellent.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now he was very he was hopeful with the science and all that stuff. You know, speaking with the the labs that are currently producing these, mm-hmm. Results. Are you guys, did they give you any sort of like, hey, this may be able to happen in the future, in the next, like you said, I'm looking forward to what may happen in the next 5 years.
Yeah.
Is it something that you can, they say that, okay, it's not stuff you can put into CODIS, and it's not necessarily something that you can use for the familial DNA. Mm. Or genealogy databases that they've been using, but we're working towards that process where what you have will be one day.
I think the public labs are doing that. Again, the private labs usually perfect these systems before the public labs will pick up on them, because obviously we're dealing with a different level of certainty. So once something has been scientifically proven and evaluated and shown to work, then my impression here is that the public labs, the BCI, the FBI labs, then will incorporate that type of technology into their system and start using it. But they're going to be behind the curve as far as where private sectors have been going. But they, again, they keep up with what the private labs are doing, and they know what is coming down the road, and they know the possibilities. And so they make the they make us aware of that. We're aware of it also, which is why, you know, we're not looking to, let's say I have, let's use a number, five. Five is my DNA number. Mm-hmm. And if I have to use three to, this is completely made up, by the way, just as a...
hypothetical.
To kind of paint a picture. So if I have five DNA and I got to use three on this test to see if it matches something, I only have two left. Knowing technology is going to change, I think I'd rather keep three or four, knowing that technology improves to the point where I can use it like I anticipate it's going to be, have more value. So you have to kind of do that. You have to be careful on what you do with it.
Yeah, because you only have so much DNA to work with, and eventually
Absolutely.
It's going to
right.
run out.
You know, and that's no secret. You know, DNA is not infinite. We have what we have. And some DNA testing will use up the DNA. So you have to be careful that you don't use up all your DNA evidence.
And in some of those other cases, you know, like the April Tinsley case, there was DNA all over the place.
Right.
I mean, the guy was leaving DNA...
Purposely.
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 You know?
We don't have that, so that makes it a little more challenging for us.
Hi, I'm Sean McCabe.
And I'm Carrie McCabe.
We are, well, married, obviously, but we're also obsessed with the darker side of things.
True crime stories, alien abductions, poltergeists. If it leaves you scratching your head and keeping those lights on at night, we want to hear about it.
That's why we host the podcast, Ain't It Scary, with Sean and Carrie.
Every week, we bring our listeners a true story guaranteed to send chills down your spine, from history's most brutal serial killers to the mystery of spontaneous human combustion.
Yep, lots of these stories leave unanswered questions behind, and you'll get to poke through the rubble of the evidence with a hardened skeptic and...
someone whose mind is more open to fun.
Yeah, that's what I was gonna say.
You can find Ain't It Scary with Sean and Carrie wherever you get your podcasts, and on social media at Ain't It Scary. Come play with us.
Now, a touchy subject, is it sexually assaulted? Was she sexually assaulted?
We don't know for sure, but we believe she probably was. Again, I go back to, why does someone abduct a 10-year-old girl? And when you start thinking about the reasons for that, ransom, family, sexual, it usually comes down to sexual. And when you look at the statistics, that's kind of where it leans. As awful as that is, that's probably the reality here. Unfortunately, due to the decomposition of her body, that will never be 100% determined. So we goes to, based upon circumstantial evidence, we believe that's probably what happened here.
That's unfortunate. As far as when her body was found, you know, the news... at the time, you know, I was going through all the clips, and a lot of the people kept saying, well, the body couldn't have been there. We're hunters, you know, we walked that area. We would have seen it. Is there any, I mean, from what everything that I've read is that the body would have been there the whole time, but
I don't think we can
determine
say
that?
For 100% certainty how long the body was there. The body was there for a while.
Okay.
Just based upon the decomposition that goes into the ground, mm-hmm. We can determine the body was there for a while. Was the body placed there the day after? We have no way of knowing. We can't put a time frame to it. What you do is, you know, you talk to the entomologists, you talk to those folks, and they'll say the body was there for quite a while. It was also a very cold winter. Not a lot of precipitation. The bottom line is the body had been in that field for a while. She'd definitely been deceased for a while, and there's a possibility maybe the body was covered up, which is why nobody saw it. I understand the arguments on both sides. If I'm a bus driver or I drive that, how do I not see somebody laying 15 feet away off the roadway?
Right.
And all one day a jogger finds that. How does that happen? You know, and there's always a possibility her body was covered with something and either blew off, was removed, whatever
possibly
the case may be.
With a curtain
with
or
a
blanket.
Correct. So we don't know that for sure. Again, a lot of these are just theories.
Mm-hmm.
So you got to be careful when you have a theory that you don't try to force the facts into the theory. You got the theory that stands on basically what you know and what's are possible. So that's not, you know, a theory can't necessarily be your all-encompassing driving force. It's just that, it's a theory. And you work with that, but you don't eliminate other things because it's not fitting into your theory. Especially when facts come that contradict it, you have to be careful.
Yeah, I think you find that a lot of times when you see cases where, you know, people are wrongfully convicted, where it's just, they get a narrow focus, and it's just like, okay, well, it had to have been this guy because it was, and then they just kind of discount everything else that comes along the way.
And I think a lot of folks that view this case from the outside are looking at bits and pieces of it. I forgot what the old story about the elephant, right? You know, but if you have the inside knowledge of the investigation and everything that's encompassing, you understand why some of this doesn't make sense that people propose. But our job is not to go out and argue with those who have limited knowledge of the case and you know, say you're wrong. It's not what we do. That serves no purpose, quite frankly. What we want the public to understand is that we need information. And I know I've used this probably 100 times in interviews, but I just picture this large puzzle. We've got all the pieces. Maybe we're missing a couple. But until we get people to help us put the pieces in the right place, you know, and then grab those couple pieces that we don't know, you know, that's kind of where we're at. We have a lot of information. We probably have enough information, you know, if I was to throw out a number, we probably got 90% of the information to solve this case. If we had 99%, doesn't do us any good until we get that 1%. You know, we got to be 100%.
The puzzle's not complete until all the pieces are in place.
So you can't get that whole view of what it is until you start putting it all together. And sometimes people give us information that helps us to clarify that picture and add a couple pieces. So that's kind of the analogy I like to use because that's how I picture this playing out, finding a few more puzzle pieces to finish it.
Do you do any of the interviews yourself?
I have not, since I've been chief since 2013, I probably have not done any interviews whatsoever. In the past I did, you know, okay. I was in charge of our detective bureau from 99 through 2013, so I did a few of those, obviously. Prior to 1999, we had other folks that were part of the investigative team that did the majority of those. All that information obviously is documented and it's well within our reach. But as far as my personal involvement, it's hard because I want to be more involved, but I know I can't. My job description doesn't allow me or afford me the opportunity to give it that much time. But I'm still involved in what's going on day to day, for sure.
Now, is there anybody actively at the FBI working on the case?
There is an agent assigned.
Okay. Yep.
And then that agent assigned, if she needs additional resources, obviously can call on anybody, including the lab, other resident agencies, whatever she needs. So if we got a tip in another state, she would coordinate with that resident agency in that state to send out a tip to have it investigated. So we use that resource quite a bit because we, as Bay Village Police, don't have the resources to fly around the country to follow up on tips and leads. It's just not possible. So the FBI has been a tremendous partner with us in this.
And that's one of those saving graces in the sense that, like, they were involved pretty much right off the bat.
They were from almost day one.
And that's because, a bunch of them lived here,
Correct. Right, in the
city. So, I mean, this is a city where people want to live. And
yeah, it says something when somebody comes in from the outside in law enforcement and they say, where should we live? We want a place that's safe, that we can raise our families, and they get told Bay Village. And that's really what happens. So you had a lot of residents living, you know, a lot of FBI agents living in Bay Village.
Now, you said that you, and I don't know if you were just saying this as just a, you know, number, but you mentioned, you know, there might be somebody with 50 or 60 interviews associated with them.
Mm-hmm.
Do you feel like you've talked to the killer?
It's really hard to know. You know, we have done so much work on individuals. You know, the circumstances of some tips are better than others. Some are more intriguing. Some get you closer to where you want to be, I believe, in the terms of the facts surrounding a suspect. But we've done so much work on some of these people that I'd be surprised if, because we've done so much, if the person was involved, just because we vet out these people completely.
So everybody that's been out there as far as the public may know, and then obviously you guys know other stuff, but for the public to know, those individuals have been vetted. Yes. Seriously vetted.
Completely. Yeah. And what it comes down to is, to rule somebody out 100%, in my mind, you've got to have an ironclad alibi with multiple independent witnesses with no skin in the game saying, couldn't have possibly done it. We know when she was abducted, this person was here. You know, we got three people that can say he was here. I'm not so narrow focused. Like, okay, somebody said he was at work. Yeah, it can't be him then. You know, we like to be sure of ourselves. So that's why we keep that pool so wide. But the bottom line is, when you do literally weeks and weeks and weeks worth of work on an individual, you have a pretty good feeling of where their involvement may or may not be. And the bottom line is, nobody's been arrested.
Speaks for itself.
Mm-hmm.
In the documentary, mm-hmm. there were some interesting things that they talked about as far as some of the ways that they went about interrogating certain suspects. Mm-hmm. That was all true?
Yeah, there was sodium pentothal, or whatever you want to call that, used on one of the suspects back in the day. That was probably 90. Hypnosis was used on witnesses and others that may have information to try to draw out additional facts. So things that you would think are, you know, movie related, obviously. Polygraphs were used as needed, multiple interviews. I mean, a lot of different techniques were used. In fact, there was a database created back in 89 as tips started coming in. And kind of a new phenomenon back there where you get so much information is, how do you take all that information and make sense of it? So they developed a database, which now you could call whatever the Microsoft database is, whatever that term is. But back in the day, they created a database out of note cards where the tips used to come in.
Mm-hmm.
That technology and the procedures that were developed through the Mihaljevic case and some of the investigative methods actually evolved into the protocol that is still used today for missing abducted children. You know, as far as getting information out right, having leads come in and making sense of all the leads as they come in and being able to analyze leads, just this multitude of information. You think of the Boston bombing or things like that, where you've got so much information flowing in that people want to relate. How do you manage all that? And this case was one of the first, certainly in this area, where that type of public input was vast and had to be organized. And some of those, like I said, some of those methods that were used are still used today.
Here's a question. Do you polygraph, now, have you used the polygraph on a lot of people? Or is that one of those things that it's just, you feel like, okay, it's time to bring in the polygraph?
Yeah, it really depends on individual circumstances. We've certainly done our share of polygraph examinations. We don't obviously force anybody to do them. Often surprising maybe to the public is we often work with attorneys and on with people. So if, you know, Joe Smith is a suspect and, you know, I want him to take a polygraph and he's got an attorney, we'll work with the attorney. And, you know, we're very cooperative in that manner. You think about it this way. If Joe Smith didn't do it, we want to know that and move on. We don't want to waste a lot of time on Joe Smith if Joe Smith wasn't involved. So the quicker we can get to that point and the more investigative methods we can use to establish that, the better. And so most of the time, people are very cooperative, surprisingly. You know, it's not their fault necessarily somebody called them in as a suspect. We know we're out there pushing for that because we want to solve this, but if Joe Smith gets called in because he's a lookalike, or Joe Smith gets called in because he knew the Mihaljevic family, or he went to the barn, or whatever the case may be, you know, he probably understands that. And most of the people we've talked to understand why we're contacting them. And they're more than willing to cooperate. And that says a lot about them in the first place.
Yeah, and then you would think that anybody that is brought up in this case, one, they want to clear their name right away.
Absolutely.
I mean, if you're, okay, you're a lookalike. I'm a lookalike. I have nothing to do with anything related to this type of crime.
Mm-hmm.
Give me a polygraph.
Yeah, and your natural inclination is, yeah, I want to get this over with. I have nothing to do with this. What do you need to do? I'll do whatever you want me to do. That is what we get the vast majority of the time.
Well, that's, I mean, at least, again, like you said, it rules those people out, and then you don't have to spend the time chasing down those leads.
Do what you can, correct.
Now, up in Michigan in the 80s, there was the Oakland County child killings.
Mm-hmm.
And supposedly there was a ring of individuals. You don't think there was any sort of thing going on like that in this area?
I do not. Not at all. No.
Okay.
I think this is a lone individual involved with this crime. Now, does that mean that this lone individual, after the fact, didn't say something to somebody or maybe help them move a body or something? We'll never know that until we find out. But the person who planned this crime, abducted Amy Mihaljevic and killed her, I believe, was an individual, not a group.
And kept it to himself.
Yeah, for the most part. It's hard for people to keep secrets to themselves. We rely on that every day in law enforcement. So there could be people out there that were told something that leads them to believe this person might be involved. Is there somebody out there who has direct knowledge? There could very well be. I want that person to call me right now. In fact, we'll stop the interview here today if they want to give me a call.
Dave.
That's kind of what we're looking for. You know, we believe there's somebody out there that knows something we don't know yet. It would be very important for us to know.
Now, this is just circling back to, like, let's see, was it 93 when Robert Ressler released his book and he kind of mentioned Strunak as a mm-hmm. possible suspect? And that, when I met with Special Agent Torsny, he kind of emphasized the fact that that didn't do a service or almost did a disservice to the
Correct.
Investigation because of the fact that, well, one, he was only here for a few days mm-hmm. and he was just putting in his 2 cents.
Right.
But the public, in their mind, they hear one of the top FBI behavioralists say, we think it was, I think it was this guy.
Yeah, right.
And boom, you know, did tips start to slow down at that point?
Well, I think what happens is the public then has a perception that that individual probably do it, they just can't prove it. And we've seen that in other instances with other names being thrown out there where, okay, this person looks good for whatever reason, and this person said he did it, so, you know, we as the public don't know any better, but this person's saying it, so it's got to be true. Those things harm an investigation. One person committed the crime, not the thousands and thousands of people we've had called in as suspects, obviously. So our job, it's as important for me to protect, well, I should say it this way, it's as important for me to find a killer as to protect the innocent people who are accused. You know, that's an important part of my job, is to not allow that information to get out there that could tarnish somebody for life and really affect them forever. If they had no involvement, they had no involvement. My job is not to react and start naming suspects or commenting on every person who did that. Again, other than to say that if somebody's called in a suspect and it's common knowledge in the public for whatever reason, you can rest assured we did a ton of work on that individual and spent a lot of time with them. I think the public gets a piece of information, thinks it's great, doesn't have the knowledge and value of all the information we have, and just takes and runs with that. And, you know, I understand that, but I think it's irresponsible to throw out names of individuals involved in a crime when you have no proof. It harms them, it harms the family, and it does a disservice to the investigation because other people will say, well, I think law enforcement knows this person did it, they just can't prove it. That's not true.
Right.
I sit here today, there's nobody that I say, I think this person did it, I'm just waiting to get, you know, more information to arrest them. We're not there.
So Strunak was definitely not the guy.
Oh, he, you know, obviously...
He had weird connections to the Amy Center and...
Yeah, there's always... But a lot of people had weird connections to the case for a variety of reasons, and that's why you look at them, right? But it doesn't mean they were involved in the homicide. And so while circumstances were unusual, that's what creates our interest. That's why we look at people. But you're right. You know, the individual comes in, he analyzes the case, he writes a book. He just happened to be here for that little snippet of the investigation and feels that was him. Had he come at any other time, it would have been another person because we had people coming in and out of the case all the time. So that's just the nature of this investigation.
And as a behavioralist, I mean, it was probably not the most responsible thing to put the name in the book, especially for the investigation that's not closed.
Correct.
But the public, of course, is going to take that as almost truth because this guy's...
Sure, he's an expert. He's a law enforcement expert. How many times you see them go on a different show and they talk about a suspect in a notorious crime in the country?
Right.
And then everybody's fixated. Well, that's got to be the guy. They're talking about him.
Well, we've got our own notorious guy. We got the guy who caught Whitey Bulger working on this case. Right. I mean.
So it's just, I think that it's the nature of the public now to grasp onto these things and run with them and think that, okay, this must be it. You know, you amateur sleuths, armchair quarterbacking, whatever you want to call
Monday morning
that.
Quarterbacks,
yeah,
whatever you want to call
just
them.
Whatever, yeah, and I get it. I understand that completely. Our job is to filter out that noise and stick with the facts. And when there's another drum beating out there, sometimes it's hard to ignore, but you really have to. You got to stick and do with what you know. It does no good to respond to those things. You can't do anything about it. Other than to say, you know, and hope people trust that you actually are working on suspects and that if somebody was named, there's probably a really great chance that, you know, police probably looked at that.
Yeah, and did their due diligence.
Yeah, and then some. Yeah, exactly.
So basically, as far as the listeners, anybody that's come up through this case, they can be confident that
Yes. They
have been thoroughly, thoroughly investigated.
Yep.
And
exactly right.
And you're still... And you're not at that point where you can say, I think it was this guy, but we're just waiting for that.
We're not there.
It's not there.
Not at all.
Do you feel like you're in a better place today than you were a year ago before we met?
I think so. I think any time that you can work on a case and, you know, eliminate and clarify, it's a good thing. Our enemy has always been the passage of time. People die. People's memories fade, people's memories change. That is our greatest enemy, is just the passage of time. So while we narrow things down and we put things that maybe in a little bit clearer focus, the passage of time sometimes negates that, you know. But again, ultimately, only history will prove whether a tip coming in the future will be the one to solve it and make the rest of that a moot point.
Now, if you were talking to the listeners and, you know, they know information, what would you like them to know?
Well, we want them to obviously call us. We've had several tipsters call in and say, look, I feel weird calling because it's been 29 years. I've been sitting on this information, and we're completely fine. We understand the dynamics behind why people didn't call back in the day. We're still available to take that information. We still want to hear about it. We don't judge. We understand completely why people have not called in the past and are willing to call in now. So just call us. You know, call the number.
So there's no judgment on anybody who's
absolutely
been
not.
Sitting on information, because no. They don't know if it's information that's pertinent or not.
They have no idea.
And you're not going to judge them based
absolutely
on...
Absolutely not. No, we understand the dynamics behind witnesses and all the things that go into why you don't feel comfortable saying something. We've probably heard it all in the last 29 years, and we don't pass judgment on it. We understand it, but we want them to come forward.
And that's really what's going to be the thing that solves this case.
I think so.
I mean, it's not, other than deathbed confession.
Exactly right.
And we're getting at that point where, like you said, the passage of time.
Right. I mean, it's going to be 30 years coming up, and, you know, that makes it very hard.
Yeah, and the individual's still out there, so... Mm-hmm. I appreciate the time again.
Not a problem. It's good to talk to you again.
Good to talk to you.
Thank you again for listening to this week's episode of Who Killed Amy Mihaljevic. If you enjoy this independently produced podcast, please help support independent journalism by clicking on the donate button on the bottom left on whokilledamymihaljevic.com. Any amount is appreciated, and it does help keep this podcast running. If you could also leave a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts, that will also help support the show and continue to get Amy's story the coverage it deserves. I will be releasing a few more bonus episodes in the months to come. And stay tuned for updates on my newest podcast, Bomb City USA, Who Killed Danny Green? If you have any information regarding Amy Mihaljevic, you can contact the Bay Village Police Department at 440-871-1234. If you have any new information, the FBI is also available at 1-800-CALL-FBI. They are also offering a reward of up to $25,000 for any new information regarding the death of Amy Renee Mihaljevic. So thank you again for listening, and be safe.
Coming up on 5 Minute News, I'm Anthony Davis. You might think it's partisan because maybe it's critical of one side or the other, but it's not, it's just the truth. And I think that's also something that's kind of unusual for Americans listening to the radio or to podcasts, because the news landscape in the States has been so partisan for so many decades. So 5 Minute News is verified, truthful, independent, unbiased, and essential world news daily.
Hi, I'm Matt Harris. Seton Tucker and I host the podcast Impact of Influence, which for 2 years covered in depth Alec Murdoch, who was eventually convicted in 2023 of murdering his wife Maggie and son Paul. That story continues to evolve, and we will cover that. Plus, we will tell you stories of other true crime events that have happened in the South. Please join us on Impact of Influence. And give us a follow on the Impact of Influence Facebook page.